And welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig here on KPFT HD Channel 3. I am a strong believer that you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. You can listen not only live on HD3 if you have one of the five or six HD radios in town. You can also listen live online at kpft.org. Just go to Listen Live and then click the HD3 channel. I will try to take calls today if anyone out there should be so bold at 713-526-8737. And, well, I'm going to have to lean forward away from the mic to do this. I will also be trying to check hashtag ThinkWing on Twitter if you have something you'd like to tweet. So I'm going to move this over here so I can kind of do that. Let's see. Twitter. See, this is all preparation, and obviously my preparation here not what it ought to be, and my computer is running slow. Okay, we'll wait on that. You know, we have a lot of conservative agendas going through around the country. Texas, of course, you can't have gerrymandering without T-E-X-A-S. That's not a spelling lesson. That's a political lesson. Then you've got North Carolina, which appears to be the poster child for crazy right now. And you have the Justice Department trying to enforce voting rights through Section 3 of the Voting Rights Bill, Voting Rights Act. So, I guess I consider this like the number one topic, which is the reason I lead off with it. I think all the crazy that we're seeing in so many of these states right now that have either conservative control or conservative representation, significant conservative representation, this just brings up, you guys need to go out there and vote. I cannot emphasize this enough. I emphasize it periodically. I have a bumper sticker, well, it's really a windshield sticker, on my car that says if the 99% voted, the 1% wouldn't matter. And that's true. In poll after poll, and I hate to be repetitious, I try to bring fresh stuff to every show, but I think this always bears repeating. Self-identified Democrats in polling consistently outnumber self-identified Republicans. So the question is, where are they on election day? When we're in a country where a presidential year, a 65% turnout of eligible voters is considered outstanding. And by the way, we don't get to that in Texas. Texas is more like 52% in a good election year. That's just sorry. And of course, now you've got the Texas legislature doing all kinds of things to suppress voting. And it's not just minorities. I mean, it's really aimed at Democrats. The fact that it picks up a lot of minorities is kind of a bonus. So, and actually funny, the Republicans are probably going to argue that in court, because the Voting Rights Act is aimed at helping to prevent minority discrimination. There will probably be a test of, you know, if the Republicans may come to court. This is actually a strategy that's been knocked around. The Republicans may come to court and go, no, Your Honor, we're not discriminating against minorities. We're discriminating against Democrats. And that is not covered by the Voting Rights Act. So it may be, yes, Your Honor, we're discriminating, but no, Your Honor, it's not minority-based. This will be an interesting case. So anyhow, vote, vote, vote. All right, going on to the next thing. The XL, actually I'm saying that wrong, the XL error heard round the world. Now I'm going to come around to that, but here's where I want to begin. I have an article in front of me from August 2012, Motor Trend Magazine by Todd Lassa, and the headline is, Why Young People Are Driving Less Is the Automobile Over. Well, I mean, it's kind of funny to sort of run across this topic because my stepdaughter just recently moved to San Francisco. She's living in an apartment there where, frankly, having a car would be a very difficult enterprise, parking-wise, cost-wise, traffic-wise, just difficult. So she is fortunate. She has a work shuttle that's right across the street and takes her about an hour to get to work, an hour to get home. I mean, really, really fortunate. Not cheap. I mean, she's paying a pretty hefty rent for this very nice location, and that hefty rent is in addition to the hefty rents paid by her two roommates. So this is an expensive deal. But she did not want a car. We thought about trying to do something for a car with her, and she didn't want it. So in this article, and by the way, I have links to what I'm going to start trying to do is I do research for a lot of these topics. I look up articles and websites and Wikipedia and journals and stuff like that. And because I believe that you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts, I will, as long as I'm copying these links for my own reference anyhow, I am going to start trying to put the links that I feel are material to what I come up with on the show on my website. So like today, the July 31st show, if you go to thinkwingradio.com, you can see a show announcement, which right now doesn't have a lot of information on it, but what it does have is some of the links that I'm going to be using for today's show. So you can look at the articles in full. Obviously, I cannot read them in full. In any case, why are young people driving less? And one of the quotes here is that marketing experts fill product presentations with statistics and anecdotes of how tuned-in youth fetishize smartphones, the internet, and keeping in touch with friends via Facebook from their loft apartments in walkable cities. Well, I think to some of that, they make a virtue of necessity because they live in cities like my stepdaughter does, where having a car is not only not entirely necessary, but can be extremely difficult. It goes on to say a little further down, the Great Recession's effect on the ability of 16 to 34-year-olds to find a good-paying job has exacerbated this. Transportation and the new in a study called Transportation and the New Generation, the share of 14 to 34-year-olds without a driver's license, unimaginable. Went from 21% in the year 2000 to 26% in 2010. In other words, the number of people of driving age under 34, the number of people who could get a driver's license of some sort up to the age of 34, it used to be 20% of potential drivers, and now it's perhaps, since this was 2010, over 26% of potential eligible drivers. At this rate, it's going to start looking like voting statistics. Let's see. And then, of course, they've got some charts, which don't do me a whole lot of good here on the air. It goes on to further say, the economics of driving are still going to be different for young people. In other words, people of this age group currently who might want to go out and get driver's licenses and or vehicles. The economics of driving are still going to be different for young people. While gas prices faithfully deflated, and this is deflated according to adjusting dollars for particular periods of time, even though the price of oil goes up, the adjusted price for inflation deflated. The economics of driving are going to be different for young people. While prices faithfully deflated after each oil shock we've had since 1973, the group that did this study, the Frontier Group, doesn't expect gasoline to come down much below $3.50 per gallon from here on. And then I made a note here that it's worth noting that, according to other statistics, incomes have not gone up much when adjusted for inflation for about 15 years. So we're talking about real price increases adjusted for inflation against essentially flat or declining wages adjusted for inflation. And this is going to be a theme that I'm going to come back to. I used the phrase at the outset, the Excel error heard round the world. That was the title of an article by Steve Bennin from April 16th, 2013. I originally heard about the article on Rachel Maddow, and I've gone to the site and looked at the article. And here's how it starts. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, this is, again, remember from April 2013, at the height of the Republicans' debt ceiling crisis in 2011, said he and his party were justified in prioritizing immediate debt reduction. Economists, he said at the time, he didn't name them, economists, he said at the time, tell us that letting total debt rise above 90% of GDP creates a drag on economic growth. Apparently, everybody at the time involved in this debate knew the economists he was talking about. The economists are a doctor or a professor Reinhardt and Rogoff. Names. Okay, Kenneth Rogoff and Carmen Reinhardt published this study a few years ago. And according to their results on their spreadsheets, when a nation's debt climbs above 90% of the nation's total economy, it necessarily serves as a drag on economic growth. The problem, as it turns out, you know, you talk about peer review and replicatable results. Well, in economics, which is what they call a dismal science, because it's at least as much art as science. But there, you know, when you start getting into the math of economics, that's something, that's something tangible that you can test. So, Michael Konchzal, I think is how the name is pronounced. It's an Eastern European name with, I don't know how to pronounce it precisely. But he sort of reworked those spreadsheets and found that the study was wrong in a variety of important ways. Several scholars at the University of Massachusetts Amherst replicated the results and uncovered serious problems. Among the most glaring, Reinhardt and Rogoff had made a coding error. In other words, I guess they had designed a macro to do some calculations from multiple places on the spreadsheet. Made a coding error in an Excel spreadsheet, which Kevin Drum, and this is where the name comes from, Drumall, called it the Excel error heard round the world. And he meant this, we think, literally, because this particular study has been used for economic planning in countries literally around the world. Austerity has essentially been brought to us courtesy of Rogoff and Reinhardt. So I have a chart in front of me, which you'll have to take my word for. How bad is it? Well, looking at the chart, according to Reinhardt and Rogoff, once a nation's debt-to-GDP ratio tops 90%, the result is an economic contraction. And they show on the chart above 90% of GDP debt, the contraction becomes about negative 0.1% or negative 0.2%, something small but real. The problem is that when you revise the data, you actually end up even above that 90% mark of debt to GDP, you end up actually with about 2.2% growth. So in other words, they have it totally bass-ackwards. And the liberals and progressives and liberal and progressive and centrist economists, including Krugman, have all been saying that the conservatives have it backward. Austerity is not the way to get out of a recession. It's not the way to grow an economy. Basically, it's a Keynesian thing or a Keynesian thing. I think it's Keynes. But it's a Keynesian thing. The basic premise of Keynesian economics is you run deficits in bad times and surpluses in good times. You're not supposed to run endless deficit like, you know, we've been good at. So you're supposed to prime the pump, is the term, during slow times, like now, and you're supposed to have surpluses, like we did under Clinton. So that's how it's supposed to work. Instead, we've had a situation where we've gone into debt during Reagan's era when times were good. We've gone into debt during war, during W's era, which is, you know, bad. So it's like debt is always good, except when Democrats do debt. And then it's tax and spend. Well, at least it's not borrow and spend, which is what we mostly see these days in modern conservatives. It's not libertarian conservatives, but the conservatives before we got to like the Rand Paul brand of Tea Party guys who don't want to tax or spend. So I guess we call them no tax, no spend Republicans. I don't know. Sometimes we'll come up with something catchy. So to get back to the Reinhart-Rogoff study on which so much of world economics has been based, the question then becomes, confronted with the evidence, will Paul Ryan or other conservatives who have relied on this study reevaluate their assumptions given the revised reality? Now, we're not saying to even change their minds, but to look at the revised study and say, I wonder if we ought to reconsider. And the quote from a gentleman by the name of Dave Roberts was, "Austerity boosters care about being debunked about as much as climate skeptics do. You cannot overcome motivated reasoning with more numbers." So essentially what we've got here is a problem which seems to be common in conservative circles with magical thinking. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that in a moment. I can try to take phone calls. Again, not great at the board, but if you call me, I will try to get you on the air at 713-526-8737. That's 713-526-8737. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT HD Channel 3. By the way, if you have found the website thinkwingradio.com a little too complicated to punch into a computer to go to the site, I have tried now to get something shorter, thinkwing.org. Thinkwing.org. Let's try it and see if it works and let me know. Okay, getting back to the Excel error heard around the world, the visible danger of spreadsheets when you have tiny, not necessarily tiny, but sometimes tiny errors that just percolate all throughout the spreadsheet. Jared Bernstein, who I think used to do some economics in the, I think he was a budget director or something in the Clinton administration, also talked about this article around the same time as Bennin did. And his comment was on the people that had revised or reexamined the work. He says, "The authors of the new paper, Herndon, Ash, and Pollen, replicate the other paper and make various corrections to A, methods and data choices, and B, a spreadsheet error. The latter, where R&R's document appeared to have left out important data that has a big impact on the results. And when Herndon, Ash, and Pollen corrected those," as Jared puts it, "boo-boos, they get the results shown in the figure below, which shows that there is, in fact, a 2.2% increase in GDP as opposed to the 0.1% decrease in GDP that the original study predicted." So essentially what we have is a world, at the very least, what you might call a worldwide growth recession, and possibly a worldwide recession which could be tipped into a worldwide depression if we're not careful, essentially based on one piece of work seized upon by people who felt it sort of fit their pre-existing belief system. And because it fits so well with their pre-existing belief system, they embraced it. And conservatives being in control in many countries in the world, that's what we ended up with. We ended up with austerity. And austerity has not worked so well, as you can see in many countries around the world, including Spain, where unemployment now is about 25%, and including Cyprus, where people actually had portions of their savings confiscated in order to get a bailout from the European Central Bank, which is basically Germany. So this kind of raises a question. And, you know, the question is, are we all sort of sliding into a downward path of prosperity, at least in the first and second world, the industrialized world and the industrializing world? There have been articles suggesting that even in the developing countries like Bangladesh, where the argument has been, well, the working conditions suck, but at least the jobs are there. And some studies have suggested that actually workers at many of these jobs that export things like clothing to the West actually pay less in adjusted terms than many of these people used to earn. So, again, what we have here is a problem with stagnant or declining wages when adjusted for inflation and currency valuation changes. So this isn't just an American problem. It isn't just a Western problem. It's really kind of a global issue. My in-laws in China, they have a retirement benefit from my late father-in-law's job. And inflation in China over the last 20 years has actually been pretty considerable. Well, they don't adjust for inflation in China when it comes to retirement benefits. It's not like in Social Security, where even the pathetic percentage that they increase it is at least an increase that kind of pyramids over time. So if my wife had not been sending some extra support to her family in China, they could have ended up living under bridges. I think his retirement benefit was something like 500 yuan a month, which at that time was 8 yuan to the dollar, and you couldn't survive on that. So she was sending money to them in order to help them to survive. So inflation is a problem, but wages that don't keep up with inflation become a bigger problem. It's essentially like a silent pay cut. So about a year and a half ago, I was looking at this topic. You know, I was reading articles, sluggish economy, and there was a little talk, and I don't think that it was taken far enough. I think they're beginning to talk about it more now, about slow growth and sluggish growth being the new normal for at least the United States, which, of course, has a worldwide impact. And I used for my sources, and again, linked on my site, thinkwingradio.com or try thinkwing.org. We'll see how that works. Articles like "The Economy, the New Normal is the Old Normal," or "Economic Sluggishness is the New Normal," or "The New Normal, Are We in a Growth Recession?" Well, I mean, from my experience with my stepdaughter going to college, my wife and my stepdaughter's father were able to finance my stepdaughter's college, and she graduated without debt. That makes her unusual and lucky. The problem is that a lot of kids are graduating now. I think the average is that the average college graduate now carries $100,000 in debt. Wow. Now, of course, that's an average. There are kids that get away with as little as $10,000 or $20,000. There are kids that end up with like $200,000. Now, when I was their age, I went to the City University of New York, Brooklyn College. I only got about 2 years there, but I was able to go to that school for something like $500 a year. Now, even allowing for inflation, that's really cheap. But I got 2 years of college, which at that time was enough to get me halfway decent jobs. If I had 2 years of college today, I might have $10,000 or $20,000 in debt for having tried college, and I could just as easily be earning $10 an hour at a retail store or minimum wage at a fast food joint, because it's not just high school grads that end up in jobs like that. If you don't have a four-year degree, getting a decent paying job, and I use that term advisedly, decent paying has changed in terms of our concept of it. You know, if a college grad gets $25,000 or $35,000 a year coming out of school, that's become pretty good. And that's pathetic. It really is. When I was 22, a good paying job was about $150 a week, about $7,800 a year. But also when I was 22, a new car cost about $3,500 drive out. Well, now a car like that would cost at least $25,000 drive out, but a good paying job is only about $25,000 a year. So you can see the disparity that's cropped up there. So I think a problem that we're seeing, I think there are two countries that are looking at very, very interesting problems going forward. China, because, and oh, we need to do a station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT HD Channel 3. You can get information about the show at thinkwingradio.com or try thinkwing.org. I think there are two countries going forward over the next generation that are going to be facing some really interesting problems, and to a large extent, problems they have brought upon themselves. China, because of their population, currently about 1.5 billion, when their population was about 1 billion or 1.2 billion, the government instituted what was considered a fairly draconian policy of one child per family. Now, typically, allowing for early deaths and such, 2.1 in an industrialized country is considered replacement. So when you talk about a one-child policy, which was not 100% enforced, but was enforced heavily, what you're talking about is there's going to be a generational baby notch or birth crash where you're going to have this rising population curve. And, of course, that the younger generation, to some extent, always supports, at least aids in support of the older generation. Plus, they provide workers to help support the services that the older generation needs, particularly the retired generation. And in China, they retire early to make room for jobs for the young. And China now is getting to the point where the one-child family babies are getting to college and entering the workforce. And what they're finding is they have a demographic notch where as the years go by, you're going to have a smaller and smaller workforce relative to an older and older retired cohort. They're going to have some serious problems adjusting to this. But you're going to have old people literally. I've been to China. And, you know, it's a communist country, which is supposed to mean, you know, socialist and take care of the worst off. And in China, I saw people living under bridges, bathing in rivers and canals, washing their clothes in rivers and canals. There is poverty in China. And I think that they're going to have some serious political and economic and social problems going forward over the next 25 years. Now, in the case of the United States, I think that our problems are going to be caused by two specific issues. Of course, one is the no tax, no spend conservatives, because government has a role in the economic life of a nation and you can't just subtract it. But the other thing is you've got kids that are coming out of college. They're typically at the age where people begin to form families, buy homes. The homes require furniture and appliances. And then they have kids, and the kids require clothing and toys and educational aids and computers separate from the parents' computers. I mean, we're talking about these are the things that drive an economy going forward. Well, you know, a starter home these days, $100,000, that's pretty much a starter home. It's like maybe 1,200 square feet, maybe three bedrooms, one or two car garage. Modest lot. Well, what do you do when you're 23 and you've met your sweetheart in college and you're getting married and the two of you together have $150,000 in college debt, which is already more than the mortgage on your starter home? Well, what you do is you don't buy your starter home. Sometimes you postpone your marriage. You try to postpone your kids, but of course we know how that sometimes works out. And that affects the housing industry, that affects the appliance industry, that affects the furniture industry. It ultimately affects things like the clothing industry. Now, coming back to the beginning of what I was talking about, if you've been sticking with me about 20 minutes ago, one of the reasons that 26% of eligible age drivers under the age of 34 are not getting driver's licenses, in some cases, they can't afford a car. It may come down to being in a car, being in an apartment. I can't afford a house, $100,000 in student debt. If they don't have $100,000 in student debt, they may be flipping burgers at McDonald's. McDonald's advises if you work for McDonald's, you should probably have a second job to help pay your bills. That's the McDonald's plan. I mean, it's hard to overemphasize what this is going to look like over the next 25 years. You know, China has their demographic baby bust problem. But we're going to have a serious economic bust, backward negative growth, if that's not a double negative, backward negative growth of people that cannot afford to buy houses, cannot afford to start families, cannot afford to take out loans. And now consider, because of the financial crash we had in 2008, when me and my wife bought our last house, we put down, I think it was something like $5,000 or $10,000. I'm not going to tell you the price of the house, but it wasn't a starter home. We put down $5,000 or $10,000 and then took out an 80-20 mortgage, which means that we got a first loan for 80% and a second loan for the remaining 20%, and that's how we financed the house. That same house now, can't do that. The interest rates are still really pretty good, but you have to put up 20%. 20%. So even for a starter house, you have to put up $20,000. This, while you're paying off your $100,000 or $200,000 in student debt, you have to accumulate $20,000 in cash. And that $20,000 in cash can't be down to your last dollar. Because generally what I have found over my life, and I'm no spring chicken, is purchasing a house is the price of admission. If you've already got a home, you're going to move your furniture in. But if it's an existing house, you're probably going to spend $10,000 or $20,000 just repainting the house, replacing the carpets, getting some rugs, maybe replacing an appliance or two. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes into a house, particularly a used one. And it's costly, which also, by the way, is what economics is all about. That effort to find that money and put that money into that home, that's what drives construction and accessories and furniture and drapes and retail and everything you can imagine. So we're going to look at 25 years, this generation at least, we're going to be looking at 25 years of deferred family creation. College debt is not a tiny problem. It's not just a problem for the students who have the debt. It's not just a problem for the parents who may have co-signed the debt, and there are some horror stories there. It's a problem for all of us. All of us who want to make a living doing something need customers, and those customers need to have money. And if they don't have money, the economy is going to do poorly. There's going to be a contraction. One of the issues that's now very upfront is minimum wage. Lawrence O'Donnell did a story last night on what would happen if McDonald's. Now, I think the federal minimum wage is something like $7.35 or $7.85 an hour. Adjusted for inflation, that means that people are being paid less than at the time that Ronald Reagan became president, adjusted for inflation. Lawrence O'Donnell said that someone had run some numbers that if you doubled the minimum wage, for that matter, if you doubled the wages of everybody who works for McDonald's, including the top guy who makes about $9 million a year, if you doubled everybody's wages, it would add about 68 cents to the price of a Big Mac. Because the fraction of labor that goes into that price is relatively small. Most of the cost of doing business is real estate, building maintenance or construction, the meat, the patties, the refrigeration, the utilities. It's not that the labor is insignificant, but the labor is not the thing that'll kill you. Now, also keep in mind, if the minimum wage goes up, it's not like one or another business will be disadvantaged. The playing field will be level. And keep in mind, there are states that have different minimum wages. Lawrence O'Donnell made the point that I think in Washington or Oregon, where the minimum wage is $10 an hour, that the price of a Big Mac is pretty much the same as the price of a Big Mac in California and San Francisco, where the wages are lower and the real estate costs are higher. So price is only somewhat flexible relative to labor cost. If everybody got a raise in the minimum wage, if the minimum wage doubled to $15 an hour, nobody would be able to advantage themselves by paying $7.50 an hour. Everybody would be on the same playing field. So McDonald's wouldn't lose business to Wendy's, and Wendy's wouldn't lose business to CC's Pizza, and CC's Pizza wouldn't lose business to Papa's, which I don't like his. I don't like him. But anyway, so everybody would be on a level playing field. And even though prices would go up somewhat, yes, that is a little inflationary, although the problem we seem to be looking at right now is potential deflation, which is worse than a little inflation. But also remember, all of these people who are living on the edge, in some cases living below the poverty line, what are they going to do when their wages double? What do they have to do? They're going to have to spend it. If they can save anything, that will be a bonus. But essentially what you're going to be doing is strengthening your consumer base, which is going to increase business. The people at the top always end up making money. If things are bad, the people at the top make money. If taxes go up and government spending increases, the people at the top make money because that government spending goes to do things which then end up in the pockets of rich people. There are statistics and charts, and I have a little bit of it somewhere on my site among, I think it's called Interesting Articles. The top 1%, let's even say the top 10%, let's be generous, they make money pretty much regardless. One way or another, they do well. So the question is, can the people under them also do well? The fact is, the top does well regardless, so why shouldn't the bottom also do at least passably well? You shouldn't work a 40-hour week and still be in poverty. You shouldn't have a full-time job and still be in poverty. You shouldn't have to work two or three part-time jobs to avoid being in poverty, which, oh, by the way, none of them give you anything like medical benefits because, you know, you're part-time. We have some serious structural problems, and this college debt issue is going to be a big contributor going forward if we don't find solutions. Now, of course, seeing problems is so much easier than finding solutions. So in order to be a little constructive, one of the solutions that I might suggest going forward is universal government service, universal civil service. That's a discussion I've had with David Brown, a.k.a. D.B. Grady. He's ex-military. And we've talked about this notion of universal service. Universal service doesn't necessarily mean everybody goes into the military. Universal service could mean helping out at homeless shelters. It could mean interning at construction firms doing government contracts. It could mean helping to teach, being teacher's aides. It could be daycare for working poor. Universal service can be many things. Of course, it creates an opportunity. If everybody has to serve in some capacity, this also creates an enlistment opportunity for the military. There are people that want to serve in the military. There are some people on the fence about serving in the military. There are no doubt a fraction of people that as long as they have to go into universal service anyhow, they'll choose to go into the military. What does that have to do with things like college debt? Well, maybe one way to absolve college debt is by working it off through universal service. You are serving a purpose for the country. You're helping infrastructure. You're helping people. You're providing social services, intellectual services. And that should be worth something. And I think, you know, government room and board, stipend, work off your college debt. Give you a way to work off your college debt. I understand the devil is always in the details. But we really need to look hard at this. We need to look hard at it because of the public service aspect. We need to look hard at it to fight parochialism in the population. There are just people that need to not spend their whole lives within 20 miles of Biloxi, Mississippi. There are people that need to see what New York is like and need to see what an Indian reservation is like and need to see what El Paso or San Diego are like. I mean, Americans get so parochial. You know, the whole point of integration is so that we're not aliens to each other. It's we are a nation of many different people, colors, faiths, ethnicities, accents. I resemble that remark. And the only way that we can learn to live together is to learn about each other and to learn to be comfortable with each other. And that is one of the perhaps most important things that universal service would accomplish. It would throw people together who might never otherwise meet and get to know each other. And it would create more societal knowledge, more societal empathy, human empathy. I've sometimes felt that, you know, the way a lot of schools organize at some point, maybe around high school, they organize a trip to Washington, D.C. or the state capitol or whatever it is so they can see how government works. I have felt for many years that, you know, we have the good and ill fortune of having a second world country on our southern border. Mexico has enormous, has pockets of terrible poverty. Now, we're not talking about you know, there are areas of Mexico that are not terribly safe these days. But I think, you know, there are so many poor villages who could use a little extra money, who could use a few extra hands, people who know how to do things and aren't busy scratching a living out of the earth, that can come into their villages and help. I think that that would be a worthwhile endeavor for a lot of teenagers, to take a week in a safe area of Mexico, in a poor village, helping to build a school, helping to teach English, helping to dig a well, helping to lay a water line. I mean, whatever it is that these kids might be able to do that the people in that village have either not the time or not the money or not the expertise to do. And you know what? One of the most valuable experiences I had was when I was going through my divorce, and that was not a happy divorce. And I spent at one point a month without a refrigerator. That was really hard. But when I finally got into a place that had a refrigerator, my celebration was going into Kroger, buying a gallon of milk, and that was the first thing that I put into that refrigerator, something perishable, which I had not been able to have in the house for a month. You know, it's given me an appreciation. It's a tiny thing, but it's given me an appreciation for what it's like to have to do without and then suddenly have something that's so simple and yet you've come to realize is so important. I think that universal service, the kind of universal service that I'm talking about, where it would take people in many directions, impact their lives, impact the lives of others, help, I think, in many ways to unify the country, if only because you would get to meet people of different types, different beliefs, different opinions, and learn to deal. I think that that's really important. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT HD Channel 3. You can also visit the website at thinkwingradio.com. I have links to some of the reference material I used to put together this show. And you can try thinkwing.org and see if that goes to the site. I think it will. If you have the inclination, you can also call 713-526-8737. We'll see if we can get you on the air. So we're down to the last 10 minutes. We've been discussing heavy stuff. Heavy stuff. New York. New York mayor's race. Anthony Weiner. It just hurts me so much. You know, I hear a lot of things about Anthony Weiner. Aside from the sexting stuff, I mean, I've heard things about why his colleagues in the House didn't like him, that he was a glory hound. He didn't do the work, but he got the publicity because of his video rants in the well of the Congress and the House. I actually like Anthony Weiner, and it kills me that he is sabotaging himself this way. But, you know, let's talk about Anthony Weiner dropping out of the race for mayor. Should Anthony Weiner drop out of the race for mayor? Has he defamed, embarrassed, ashamed New York City so much that he should drop out of the race for mayor? Well, you know, we had the WWE diva running for the Senate in Massachusetts. No one said she ought to drop out. We have idiots who think that science comes from the pits of hell. Well, a few people said they should drop out, but they didn't. We have people like David Vitter, who actually has gone to prostitutes. Republicans, they don't worry so much about stuff like that. It's the Democrats that seem to be very prudish and say, you must resign, you must resign. It's too embarrassing. We can't deal with this. So, I mean, am I excusing Anthony Weiner's behavior? No. I mean, it's stupid. It's beyond stupid at this point because it's already cost him one career. And he was unable to fight the behavior even after paying terrible consequences. So, but should he drop out of the race? And Elliot Spitzer, I mean, talk about the pot calling the kettle black. Anthony Spitzer is saying, yes, I think Anthony Weiner should drop out of the race. Anthony Spitzer, or Elliot Spitzer, the guy who actually physically touched women, he is putting himself morally above Anthony Weiner, who has not actually physically interacted with any woman. He hasn't actually, to our knowledge, been with a prostitute, cheated on his wife, except, you know, mentally, textually. Elliot Spitzer went to prostitutes, and he's going to sit in judgment of Anthony Weiner? Okay. Anthony, I would love to see you as mayor. I don't know if you would be able to function as mayor, but I don't think he should drop out of the race because, really, it's the right of anybody to run for office, and it's the right of the voters to not elect them. Anthony Weiner has the desire. He apparently has the energy. Whether you understand it or not, he apparently has the support of his wife. He apparently has the financial resources going forward, at least for the time being. There's absolutely no reason for him to drop out. If he is not suitable to be the mayor of New York, the voters will not let him get into the runoff. And I think all of this talk of him dropping out of the race is crazy. Okay. Last thing that I think we're going to be talking about today on what might be a lighter note kind of falls under the category for me of once a snake, always a snake. I am not a fan of reality TV that develops entertainment out of the abuse of contestants. I was watching America, I think it was America's Got Talent, the one with Howie Mandel. I think it's America's Got Talent. And what's his face? Howard Stern is one of the judges. Now, Howard Stern. I mean, yeah, I've got a friend of mine, Glorice McPherson, here. She's kind of sitting in. She's going, oy.
Howard Stern.
Yeah, Howard Stern. But I will tell you what. Howard Stern, when he doesn't like an act, I have to say he's honest. Mm-hmm. He is clear as to the reasons. He is not gratuitously mean. Simon Cowell and some others on TV make a career out of being, and I use the term advisedly, entertainingly cruel. So, Simon Cowell, what kind of person is Simon Cowell when he's not being entertainingly cruel on X Factor or whatever he's on. Well, here's a headline I ran across today. Simon Cowell expecting first child with close friend's wife, Lauren Silverman.
Wow.
Ah, so he's not just a snake for entertainment. He's really a snake. Apparently, what happened was this woman, Lauren Silverman, was going through a divorce with her husband, the friend of Simon Cowell. And apparently, Simon Cowell must have felt she needed some emotional support. And this emotional support turned a little bit more intimate. And intimate enough that they're now expecting a baby together. Now, just to show you how bizarre these things are, I mean, he couldn't even wait until the divorce was final to get with his friend's wife. They're going through the divorce. And it's like, oh, I want to comfort you. They're comforting me at the same time. That's okay, too. So the snake Simon Cowell got his friend's estranged, perhaps, wife pregnant, not divorced. She's about 10 weeks along, an insider told a magazine. This is, let's see, New York Daily News from July 31st. The 36-year-old mother-to-be is still married to, as it is put, one of Simon Cowell's close pals, Andrew Silverman, who was a real estate mogul in New York City. Oh, Lauren and Andrew have been unhappy in their marriage for some time, and the divorce has been in the works for a while, the source said. So as, this is the quote I love, as their marriage deteriorated, she and Simon, Mrs. Silverman and Simon, became close. Cause and effect becomes a question here, folks. What makes this, I think, a little different is that Simon Cowell, his ex-fiancée, Megan Husseini, his, I guess, to-be wife, the mother of his child, Lauren Silverman, and his close friend, Andrew Silverman, were all seen on a yacht together in St. Barts on January 4th. So you see, people that pretend to be mean and vaguely sociopathic, they're not necessarily pretending. They're just mean, maybe borderline sociopaths. They don't care about anybody but themselves. So I guess the way I would sum that up is they don't just play mean, abusive people on TV. They're mean, selfish, abusive people. And we make them rich because we watch them. And I guess a question we should ask ourselves at least occasionally is, should we be doing that? Well, looking at the clocks, let me see. I've got three different clocks here. Let's see how much time I've got. Okay, according to my clock, looks like I've got about 3 minutes. So I will thank you for listening out there. Remember that this show will be archived on KPFT for about 60 days. I will also be posting it on my website, thinkwingradio.com. I have an archive there of pretty much every show I've ever done going back to May of 2010. Hopefully you'll see a learning curve if you go through all that. Thinkwingradio.com, thinkwing.org. You can email me at thinkwingradio@msn.com. And a little bit of news here. I will be sitting in for Dwayne, our fearless general manager, this coming week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I think that's the 5th, 6th, and 7th of August. I'll be sitting in at 9 a.m. And hope to have phone calls from you folks, because that's really the kind of show I enjoy. I love getting callers. Conservatives, moderates, progressives, liberals. I love getting callers. So I will be looking forward to that. Let's see. I need to kind of get our music started here. This is the problem with running your own board is, you know, you just... Okay. So now we're going to bring up the music. I think we're going to bring up the music. There we go. Bringing up the music. So I will be back here next Wednesday, 2 p.m. Central Time to 3. I will be on KPFT FM 90.1 Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 9 a.m. I think that Monday and Tuesday is going to be a one-hour show, 9 to 10. I think Wednesday is 9 to 9:30. I will really be looking forward to talking to you folks and hope to hear from you because, frankly, the phone calls are the most fun that I have doing this show. I wish you all well. Have a great day. Have a great weekend. I'll talk to you next week.